approval. They may very well want that approval. But it's a different question then. It's maybe a question of the tribe feeling that it can enhance its position now by getting the approval, not that it has to have it in order for the document or the law or the regulation to become effective. The regulation or the law would become effective then not because of the federal governmental structure under the IRA, but because of the inherent sovereignty of the tribe. And just because the tribe has organized under the IRA does not mean that the inherent sovereignty is now gone. It's still there. At least that's our argument. It's still there. There's just simply an organization here that's an IRA organization, but it leaves this other power, this latent power of the people that Mr. Kotchtog, that still is there. Nothing happened to it.
I wonder, what I was going to suggest now, if you will allow me to do so, is that in a moment we break for a cup of coffee for 5 minutes, and then we'll ask Ralph Lerner and Ted Chamberlain to speak, and one or two others who wish to speak, and perhaps give a few minutes to any of our guests from the lower 48. I almost said the United States, but I mean the lower 48, who wish to say anything before we disperse at four. But could I ask the lawyers especially, and anybody else who during the week mentioned a case name, Martinez or so-and-so versus somebody else, or a name that might not be apparent to the typist who's going to type up this record, would you just take a moment now and write down any of these difficult names on a piece of paper and hand them in to Jim Sykes, who's at the console there. And let's have a cup of coffee and then reconvene in a few minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Could we start now? And what I propose to do, if I may, is this. Ted Chamberlain has found the actual words of the trust arrangements in Australia, and I think he might read those out for the record, just so that when we use this transcript again, it's complete. And then David Case has a question for Walter Parker, and then Vernita Zillis has a number of questions that she wants to state, and then we might just go around and, starting with Mr. Lerner, have any observations, all of you, if we can reach all of you, wish to make before we close. So perhaps Ted Chamberlain, could you give us the benefit of that material?
Yes, this is the legislation, just reference to the legislation passed in Australia that was referred to earlier. This is specifically the Northern Territories legislation, which is legislation under the authority of the Commonwealth of Australia, under the federal government of Australia. It was passed in 1976, called the Aboriginal Land Rights Act, brackets Northern Territory. It provides for the grant of land to Aboriginal land trusts which hold title, quote, for the benefit of groups of Aboriginals entitled by Aboriginal tradition to the use or occupation of the land concerned. That's the end of the quotation. Aboriginal land is an estate in fee simple and is inalienable. The land trusts have no independent power of initiative. The traditional owners have the predominant position and instruct the land councils, which are established under the Act, and through the land councils, the land trusts are instructed. A land trust can only act on the direction of a land council, which is not to be given unless the traditional owners consent and Aboriginal communities or groups affected have been consulted. Now, the difficulty is in determining the mechanism for consultation by those land councils. The land councils are established under the authority of the Act out of the membership of the Aboriginals living in the area of the land council, and the members are chosen in accordance with such method or methods of choice and holding office on such terms and conditions as is or might be approved by the minister from time to time. That's the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs. What that has meant is that there are a whole range of situations in the land councils where members are appointed for a period of years which vary. Elections in some cases are held, in other cases are not. The attempt is to make that process as consistent with Aboriginal traditions as possible, but there has been a considerable amount of concern that those land councils themselves are European institutions, in many ways inconsistent with Aboriginal traditions, and posing another barrier to the effective exercise of authority over the land by the Aboriginal communities. I'm sure you'll hear much more about this next week, but I just thought it might be useful to get something of that on the record.
Thank you. David Case, your question for Walter Parker.
Right. This is something I probably should have asked at the last session, but it just recurred to me. And we just discussed this a few minutes ago, Mr. Parker and I. In your paper, you said that the Claims Act and perhaps the Claims Act and the Statehood Act in combination were intended to afford the state its selection rights over economically valuable and settlement lands. And by economically valuable, I believe you meant resource lands and settlement lands, lands where people would be actually building homes and the like. And that as to the village corporations, they were by virtue of the Claims Act to select habitable lands. And I wonder if you could comment a bit on the meaning of the term habitable, and as well as the nature of the kinds of lands that the state was interested in.
Yes, and starting with the Statehood Act, when Congress's great fear when Alaska petitioned for statehood was that the state would be a real drag on the national budget and would not be self-supporting. So the state acquired the rights to 104 million acres of land with the intent that out of that 104 million acre land base, it would be able to craft an economy which would lessen its demands on the federal budget. The Alaska Constitution, as most of you know, was moot on the question of Alaska Native rights to land or anything else. And in the first years of statehood, the state selected its lands primarily near the white settlements, near the highway corridors, and in some cases, such as Prudhoe Bay, near what they hoped would be major, give them control of major resources, and with great luck, of course, in the case of Prudhoe Bay. At the time that the Secretary Udall put the land freeze on in 1966, the state had selected about 26 million acres, or one-fourth of its entitlement in the patterns as I have just stated, and had selected practically no land in Alaska Native villages or near Alaska Native villages. With the, they had had land transferred in the form of airports and other former federal reservations, but not selected. So when the claims settlement was crafted, there were 206 villages which qualified under the terms set down by the Congress as Alaska Native villages. And there are only about another 60 places in Alaska which are communities in any sense. And they have, of course, some of them have substantial populations of Alaska Natives, but are not considered Native villages. So those 206 places were generally located just by historic utilization at the places that it was most suitable for people to live in the Arctic or a subarctic climate, generally along the rivers, near the seacoast, and so forth, mainly with the easy access to subsistence resources. And that's what I meant when I said most habitable, habitable in that sense, not habitable in the sense of, in the Western sense of best suited for economic development. And the problem of the fact that was recognized that the villages had historically moved around considerably, but no one was able to satisfy that very dramatically. A lot of villages, however, did make their land selections to incorporate future sites which they might want to move to at some future time, and that kind of foresight was put in by the villages themselves. And we can go on, but that's generally what I meant.
The reason I wanted to ask this question now is because it, I think it bears on the question of what institutions might be best or the best options for the control and use and management of these village lands. And my question, I guess, is if the village lands were selected primarily to be available for subsistence purposes, and that was their primary value, that implies to me that there was relatively little cash value. In other words, these lands are not the kinds of lands that would be convertible into cash. Their value was not in resources below the ground. It was not in an attractive highly valuable commercial location. And is that correct, generally?
Yes, it was the luck of the draw as far as, since the villages only got surface rights. Why, for the villages, it was just the luck of the draw on where you happened to be at that moment in history as to the economic value in Western terms. Southeastern villages, some of them, as you well know, have enormous value in timber, and some of them have already realized that value. And for most of the villages, why, it's the subsurface resources that are, of course, going to have the most value, and the subsurface resources belong to the region. And the Congress, viewing the Act in its totality, assumed that those subsurface values would find their way, of course, to the village stockholders through their roles as regional stockholders in the regional corporation. And the requirement for dispersing 70% of the value of subsurface resources across all the corporations, which of course has caused a great deal of debate since the Act, was simply an attempt to achieve equity across the board, recognizing that all regions were not going to be able to have the same economic value in their subsurface or surface resources.
But then what is the, I wonder if you could comment on the propriety or the utility of having the surface lands, which often have a non-economic value, having them managed and controlled by profit-making corporations. It strikes me as a bit discontinuous to have profit corporations responsible for the management of non-economic resources.
The option was there to for the corporations to create themselves as nonprofit corporations. They were under the corporate laws of Alaska. They could have gone either way, but they did in effect have to form a corporation to hold the land. That was the requirement, and it was chosen, I think, as the most flexible vehicle that they could come up with at that time to hold the land. And I think that, you know, if the Alaska Natives had wanted to put, at that time, those who were negotiating for Alaska Natives had wanted to put some kind of trust requirement in, which would have, in effect, held the surface resources inviolate, that could have probably been negotiated. I'm not sure. Things began to happen very quickly in the last year of the claims settlement.
All right. Do you have any idea why there were no nonprofit corporations formed?
The dialogue, as I experienced it in talking it over with people from many villages, was that it is possible to form a nonprofit corporation without any mandate from ANCSCA. That option's open under state law anyway, and a good many nonprofit corporations have been formed throughout rural Alaska to provide services, and some, you know, have done it very successfully. And if you form the nonprofit corporation to, in effect, provide the government-type services, why, you were letting the state and federal government kind of off the hook on providing those services. So there was a feeling at that time that the new corporations shouldn't be burdened with providing the services of a government. And that, I think, governed a lot of people's decision making in 1971, 72, 73, when they were making these decisions.
Okay, thank you very much.
Vernita Zillis, you have a few questions you wanted to put on the floor.
Thank you, Judge. My name is Vernita Zillis. I have the great honor and pleasure to be the sister to Sheldon Kachetag, and as he already said, we are from Unalakleet. I'm Inupiaq, and the questions that I have were not originally the questions that I was going to present, but in the interest of time, I will present, I think, three questions with accompanying observations to people who have been here since Tuesday. You'll forgive me if I seem disjointed at times. I think that I'm maybe running out of the kind of energy that this attending this review hearing has given me. My first question, I guess, would be addressed to Walt Parker. I don't know what authority he might have to represent the state of Alaska or the federal government, but I wonder whether he views the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, as some natives do. It's been called privately a State of Alaska Benefit Act and the United States Benefit Act, because the reason why ANCSA was enacted in the first place was so that, for instance, the federal land freeze could be lifted. The state of Alaska had sued the federal government because the federal government said that until these land claims are settled, you know, no pipeline can be built. And as we all know, since the pipeline has been built, 80 or 90 or 95% of their operating money has been derived from the pipeline. So definitely, the state of Alaska not only had a very high priority interest in getting ANCSA enacted and enacted quickly, certainly, they have benefited greatly from the passage of ANCSA. And extending that, the federal government, in receiving its share of pipeline revenues, has also benefited greatly from ANCSA. And adding to that, they have put themselves in this position of both of them at one at the same time protecting our interests, as they say, and protecting their own commercial interests in the pipeline. A good example of this is a person who is called Eskimo John. His land was crossed by the pipeline, and it was crossed unlawfully, and he sued. But the state of Alaska, you know, definitely had an interest in making sure that this avenue through his land was kept open. Now, how they proposed to protect his rights while at the same time being required by their own constitution to protect their own rights is beyond me. And it's the kind of question that we as natives run into all the time, that at the same time that they propound to protect our interests, they are, in effect, required by their own constitution to protect their own. And this is why I believe that it would be to our mutual interest to remove this conflict, to have the Alaska Natives recognized as separate, certainly, and equal, certainly. Another thing that I can't understand is why this whole question of of our land trust is so ludicrous. I completely agree with what my brother brought out, that why is it not possible for us to be trustors of our own lands? Inupiaq people speak in analogy all the time, and so I'll use an analogy, and it's relevant to ANCSA. Under ANCSA, I have shares, and my son has shares, and my daughter doesn't have shares. My son will, I hold my son's shares in trust for him until he's of an age to take care of them himself. To protect my daughter's interests the way the law is written right now, I expect my son, should I die before my daughter can inherit my shares, I expect my son to take over for me and hold them for me, for her. Now, if we go from this small, and certainly I can understand that the land is at least in the Western view, a lot more important to worry about than shares in a corporation. The fact is that my shares are my land. Why? Ada Deer spoke to this. Why is there continually this attitude of the United States government, the state of Alaska, any state, toward American Natives as parents to children? This may have been relevant when we didn't have competent thinking people, or we've always had competent thinking people, but people who are educated in the Western ways. As soon as those people became educated, why did this system yet continue? I'm going to be brief today. I'm going to go on to another question, and I wish that Mr. Parker would bear my question in mind. I've noticed a certain reluctance, maybe it's not a reluctance, maybe it's just a non-recognition of the importance of American language. American language, here I am, I'm disjointed. The American Native language. You know, that was almost taken away from us. It came so close to be taken away from us. I can say to you, and this is akin to your children learning their first words. Here I am, I'll be 34 in July, and I can barely put together a sentence in my own language. Wanga tiga kutkuk. Now, all that is, you know, my name is Renita. I'm an Inupiaq. I'm from Unalakleet. I'm glad you're here. And yet, it took me a half an hour to make sure that I had it right. But yet, when I say those words, you know, there's no question. We spoke about what is an Indian, what is an American Native, what is an Inupiaq. When we talk our language, all of that doubt and confusion that arose at the first contact with the Western culture, at the first time that most of us began to speak English over Inupiaq, for the first time, you know, okay, when I say those words, there's no doubt in my mind what my identity is. I'm Inupiaq. How many people speak Inupiaq? Anybody can learn English. And when I eat my foods, as Russell Jim so eloquently pointed out, there's no doubt as to my identity. When I eat when I eat dried fish or seal oil or surah, the willow leaves soaked in sea, you know, you name it. The way that we fix things, that you know, people come up and the way that we measure strangers is how willing they are to accept our foods, to try to learn a word of Inupiaq here and there. Because that's us. And so I wondered whether if it would be possible, and I guess this would be directed at Judge Berger and the rest of the commission, if you could explore as you go through the Native villages just how important their language is. Because when I look around Alaska today, the places where the people have kept their language are the strongest politically as well. And I mean Barrow, I mean, the Yukon-Kuskokwim area. I mean, St. Lawrence Island, Kotzebue Nana region. They keep their language, and they've kept whatever power they've been able to. And finally, a question that I have about the provisions of ANCSA itself. One of the things that consistently puzzles me when I try to muddle my way through the act itself, and I'm, you know, I've been thinking about becoming a lawyer, and as soon as I open up a book like the one that is required, you know, to cover ANCSA, and when you see the subsection this and that and this and that, you know, it's daunting. But one of the things that does puzzle me is this. ANCSA provided, it made provisions for us to be compensated in money for lands which were refused to us, to which we felt we had a claim, and which, you know, they were acknowledged within ANCSA. The United States, whether it liked it or not, when it enacted this instrument, left a paper trail. And we're going to use this paper trail. But one of the things that bothers me is, so they within ANCSA said, look, we can't give you this land, but we'll give you money, $1 billion. We'll give you the money for what we can't, for the land that we can't give you, and we'll give you 44 million acres. But they tied it together. The money is tied to the land. I can't understand that. Why can't we just own the land? So that if the corporations fail, we'll still be here. Now, I heard one of the Alaska Native Corporation executives up there, and he explained somehow why this was impossible. But will someone explain it to me in clear terms? Because it makes no sense to me. Just a final observation. I find a delicious, I have two halves in my brain. One is Western and the other one is Inupiaq. The part that's delicious is the Western idea that this is 1984. The other half, the Inupiaq part, it's bitter, because with the advent of 1984, everybody's talking about George Orwell and his book, and they're saying, aren't we lucky, you know, that this was just a warning vision, and everyone's heeded the warning. And shortly after I read that, I walked across town, and I looked at all the people in their cars, waiting at traffic lights for the green light, you know. They weren't heeding the laws of science. They were heeding what was set down for them by a pervasive entity. You will stop. You will not go, even no matter how much sense it makes to go. Those kinds of laws, of course, were meant to be guidelines before, but now they're something else. Well, it's not that far of a leap to ANCSA. You know, you have people who know the answers, but they're sitting at some intersection, and they're waiting for the green light. Martin Luther King was the one who said, "All it takes for evil to flourish is for good men to remain silent." And, you know, I'm so glad that we have good men and women, of course, here who are removing themselves from the silence of other people who are, I'm sure, good men. I'd like to thank Judge Berger again for his indulgence, and I'd like to wish again the commission the very best of luck in continuing the work that's begun, and I thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that the last question that Vernita Zilitz asked, why is the land tied up with the fate of the corporations, is one that we've struggled with, and I don't expect you to answer it at all. If you can in 120 seconds, please do. But we have struggled with that for a week, 2 weeks now. What was said about the areas of Alaska where the language is strong, I noticed that those are all Eskimo regions of Alaska. I intend, as the commission travels throughout Alaska, it is impossible not to notice where the language is strong and where it is not. And of course, in the villages we visited in Amonok and Tununuk, it is clearly very much the language the people speak. But I wouldn't draw any conclusions at this stage about whether the use of the language is necessarily the most important factor in continuing to think of oneself as a Native person. I think that is a most complicated question, and the answer is not by any means clear-cut. That's my preliminary observation, and maybe I'll reach a different conclusion, but maybe I'll reach a conclusion such as that was urged, but I'm not at all certain about that. The perhaps, Walter Parker, we might ask you to just say anything you wish about those questions, because your name kept coming up as a representative jointly of the federal and state governments, in addition to your other capacities.
It's difficult to follow such eloquence, but I will can only respond as a citizen of the state of Alaska and a citizen of the United States at this time, having had no formal authority in either government since 1979. I always viewed the claim settlement from the beginning as just a part of the development of the future of Alaska Natives within the framework of living in Alaska and dealing with the governments in which they deal. It's why in my paper I brought in the example of one of our oldest village sites, Tununuk, that has been in existence for 3,700 years, which Byron Mallott later picked up on, and where one hopes that as the people of Tununuk maintain that tie with the land, if we have some luck in working out the present situation, that they might live there another 3,000 years and deal with who knows what future governments. But the advantage that we have in Alaska that has been lost in so much of the rest of North America is that the basic relationships between the people and the land and the wildlife have not been totally disrupted, and where they have been disrupted, it's been by legal and governmental interventions and not by nature. So I hope that through educating, as Sheldon and Alfred and others pointed out, more important to educate the people living in the urban areas than Alaska Natives on most of these questions, but certainly through educating we will be able to work out a better future. And it's so critical at this moment in history, as the Alaskan population expands dramatically, that we do everything possible to protect that land and wildlife base upon which the future of Alaska Natives is more firmly rooted than in any government that they have to deal with now or in the future. So I think we just have to proceed to try to do our best, and I would say that in trying to handle this with several governors, I've never had the response from the state of Alaska I would hope on these issues, but I keep hoping that in the future, why with some luck in the electoral process, we will get a state government which is more responsive in these areas than they have been in the past.
Well, thank you, Mr. Parker. We've reached the hour, virtually the hour of closing, and since all of those here from Alaska are invited back next week in one capacity or another, and I do hope you will be back next week, and I repeat that we will start again Tuesday at 1:15. And perhaps I might treat what Walter Parker just said as a closing statement on behalf of all Alaskans present, and invite our guests from the Lower 48, to whom we are most grateful for their having spent a week with us, starting with Mr. Lerner and proceeding around the table. If you have a few closing observations, I would certainly welcome them at this stage. Mr. Lerner, please. Yes,
I didn't think I'd have an occasion to make yet another swan song to Alaskan Alaskans. The misgivings that were prompted by Mr. Konigsberg's remarks and expressed by Mr. Kotachug and Mr. Johnson, I think stir some very important problems of self-government. And maybe it's worth taking just a minute to bring those out into the open. They show the limit, that's the misgivings that you two raised about this, show the limits of that kind of a formula, a kind of an incantation that says power comes from the people. I mean, that sentiment could be expressed in other ways. You could say popular sovereignty, or you could say that political authority rests on some popular basis. That's old standard American doctrine. But the misgivings that Mr. Kotachug and Mr. Johnson expressed really grew out of a concern to have it both ways. Somehow to have a hard bound control in order to achieve some good, but that hard bound control ought also to be overridable under certain circumstances. Now, it happens that other people thinking about their self-government, people very different from the native peoples of Alaska, wrestled with exactly that problem. And one of them said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. The problem consists in this: in enabling men, in enabling the governed, excuse me, in enabling the governors to control the governed, and enabling the governed to control the governors. Okay? You've only got men to rule over men. And that doesn't matter whether they're white or Inuit or what have you. So on the one hand, you're unwilling to have the dead hand of the past to control the living. What if 100 years from now you want to use that land that you committed in a certain way? You want to use it in another way? Are you bound by that earlier generation who could not perhaps have foreseen the circumstances that that later generation lives under? At the same time, you want to prevent any existing government, or let's put it this way, you want to guard against the corruptibility of any existing government. Because at any point, you've only got a group of people who can be bought. You don't know. That, I think, comes down to that really deep, difficult, and indispensable question that only Native peoples can answer for themselves. If the subsistence way of life is indeed indispensable to being Inuit, or what have you, then that would point one way. When I say that the subsistence way of life, I don't mean that each and every Inuit has to live that life, but that it somehow has to be available for those who want to live that life, okay? Then that argues, fix as much as possible, the preservation of the land in its present relatively virgin condition. But if it's conceivable that way of life might take very different forms in some distant future, then you've got to preserve some flexibility. Who can answer that for you?
Ada Deer?
I appreciate very much the honor and the pleasure of being invited to participate in this Alaska Native Review Commission session. It's been a tremendous and exciting experience participating in this high-speed seminar with the minds of Professor Johnson and other professors here and the Native peoples. I've learned a lot and am heartened by what I've heard.